Science is the great antidote to the poison of enthusiasm and superstition. Hi, I'm Juliette Selgren, and this is my podcast, The Great Antidote, named for Adam Smith, brought to you by Liberty Fund. To learn more, visit www.adamsmithworks.org. Welcome back. Today, on February 26th, 2024, I'm excited to be talking about a few different topics that might not seem related, but the common theme is the man I'm interviewing, and I'm so excited. We're going to be talking about populism and cannabis, obviously two very different topics, but I'm going to be inviting Stan Verger, or Voiger in the American pronunciation. Learned 2 seconds ago that my mother has been pronouncing his name right and other people not necessarily right, not right in the original sense, to the podcast. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and studies oh so many things, so I'm excited to get into it today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Juliette. Delighted to be joining you.
So, first, what is the most important thing that people my age or in my generation should know that we don't?
Well, these are extremely difficult questions we're starting out with. Fortunately, later on, we'll talk about cannabis, and hopefully things will get a little more straightforward. I had about 2 minutes to think about this question, and the answer I've come up with, no, that's fine. The answer I've come up with fits in nicely with that that limited time available. Because what I will say is I think the something you don't fully realize when you're in your early 20s, or at least I certainly did, is how limited your time on this world is going to be and how busy you will be as your personal and professional lives progress. And suddenly it won't feel like the number of hours in the day, the number of days in the week is effectively limitless the way, at least to me, it felt when I was about your age. And instead, many, many, many hours will be taken up by obligations that are difficult to avoid, though, or that you should not want to avoid. And instead, you'll have a very limited amount of time left to do new things, to do the things you enjoy doing for their own sake. And so that's something I think I wish I had realized. That's right. But that's necessary sense of the situation. I think your time is just limited, and you've got to try to make the most of it. And there are things you can start earlier to make things easier later on. I don't know. I had a child very late. I guess, you know, certainly by historical standards, that's something that maybe in some ways is easier later in life, but in other ways, it's certainly a lot easier earlier on.
What are some of the ways, and obviously this is going to look a little different for everyone, but what are some of the ways that you have made the most, even knowing that there are these constraints?
Well, part of it is I've just grown much more disciplined and efficient over time. It's very easy to spend a lot of hours watching TV. It's very easy to spend time doing things that other people can do better than you. And I think, you know, between, you know, just kind of sitting around doing nothing and effectively outsourcing activities, I think you can save quite a bit of time.
So right now I'm studying math so that I can do econ. And I've learned to like math. But I think if I were to put an estimate on how much time it would take me to do a math problem compared to my math major peers, it probably takes me a good 10 times the amount of time it takes them. So I would say this is definitely not my comparative advantage, right? I'm not the...
But this is not something you can outsource, right? Because here, if they do it, you don't get the result. Because the result is you understanding how to do the math or whatever, or at the very least, you passing your math class. And that's not something you can outsource. I don't think that's an area where it really applies.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, I could choose not to take a math class, but I guess I choose to take it for a reason. And so...
Yeah.
Okay. So it's more.
Yeah. Don't try to get out of your math homework. That's not what I was trying to get you to do.
So maybe hire an accountant.
Your mother is going to get mad at me.
Hire an accountant, but don't.
Get your groceries delivered. You know, that kind of stuff.
Don't avoid doing your math homework if you actually want to get a PhD in economics.
That's right.
No, that's a great answer. I wanted to start by asking you a few questions about populism and kind of what's happening in the world today. You wrote something recently at The Unpopulist, and you've written for AEI about this, about the Netherlands, and the political situation in Holland. It's an issue that you've been following pretty closely. So can you give us a quick overview about what's happening? And especially for listeners who might not be familiar with the situation, especially because in America, we tend to be very America-centric. Can you give us an overview of the Dutch farmer protests and what triggered this widespread movement and what's going on with the recent elections and all of that?
Sure. So the Netherlands, even though it's a relatively small country in terms of, you know, just the land area and a very densely populated one, has a pretty large agricultural sector, very high output per farmer, that uses basically all of the available non-urbanized space in the country that is not a nature preserve, right? So because of the high population density, the agriculture is often very co-located with more densely populated areas. In fact, the first time my wife came to the Netherlands, we were at my parents' house, kind of wandering around in the neighborhood, in this little square with bars and restaurants, you know, very sort of European looking. Then we turn a corner and suddenly we're in this field and there's cows right next to us, right? You wouldn't, those kinds of abrupt transitions, you don't see as much in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so that's important context to keep in mind as we go through politics. So, the Netherlands starting in the '70s, like all other Western countries, has had a pretty active environmental movement. And one thing that's quite specific to the Netherlands is that environmental movement has been very focused, on nitrogen emissions from farming. And so the concern there is, you know, you use a bunch of fertilizer or you produce a lot of manure, that those products contain nitrogen that is harmful to biodiversity at the very local level, right? So this is a completely different problem from CO2 emissions, right, with their global effects and whatnot. Here we're talking about the super local spillovers from agricultural lands onto nature preserves. So, you know, you have this movement to push back against that, to designate a ton of areas as protected nature preserves. That in the 80s and 90s then got funneled into European Union systems of nature preserves, where the Netherlands really just designated a ton of parts of the country as nature preserves. Now, the Netherlands kept asking for exemptions from European Union rules on how to protect those areas, but that has in more recent years, has gotten harder and harder as courts started pushing back against not completely abiding by restrictions on nitrogen emissions. As a result, and here we get to the politics, the Dutch government has now seen itself compelled to pretty dramatically restrict nitrogen emissions. Now, you can do that in different ways. One, you just dramatically reduce the size of the agricultural industry, in particular, where it comes to the livestock part of it. Two, you can try to get rid of some of the nature preserves. That's legally very, very difficult. And three, you can try to, through technological progress or other abatement techniques, try to reduce nitrogen emissions. The government has been trying to push for a compromise between Route 1 and Route, really all three. They want a delayed reduction in nitrogen emissions and then combine Route 1 and Route 3 in the long run, right? So some technological advancement, but also just paying a bunch of farmers to stop farming. As a result, the farmers have felt very threatened. They had a set of big protests, really not in the past few months so much, but in particular in the run-up to our most recent provincial elections, which took place last year. And in that election, a new party, the Farmer Citizen Movement, miraculously became the largest party in the country. And so they now have a number of seats in provincial legislatures, and they're the largest party in the Dutch Senate. And so that is where the situation stood about a year ago. we had a general election in November, where the farmers did not do as well, but a different party from a very different sort of movement within what you can broadly designate as the populist right, Geert Wilders' Party for Freedom, which is an anti-Islam party, anti-immigration party, did extremely well. And so now we're in a situation where those two parties are kind of seen as pretty natural candidates to try and form a new government, which we're in the process of doing, which is not going very well for a number of reasons. One, most other people don't really want to govern with Wilders because he has a 25-year track record of opposition to freedom of religion and just sort of general hateful speech about Muslims in the Netherlands and about immigrants from Muslim countries in particular. His party also only has one member, which is Geert Wilders himself. Then the farmers are a new party, and so not clear who can staff a government coming from their side. There's not a party that did pretty well in November that's less populist, but also new, and they're not quite ready to govern. So, you know, it's all chaos. And now various people have been negotiating since November to form a new government. They haven't succeeded yet. I don't know if they will. The farmer protests have started warming up a little bit again, but this time in a broader European context. Recently, the highway connecting the South Netherlands to Antwerp was blocked by farmer protests that involved some violence. And I don't know that we are close to either finding a sustainable long-term solution for the nitrogen crisis or to a new government that brings on board some of these more populist parties that have had electoral success in recent years. So that was a very long answer. I'm happy to go into more detail or less detail on any of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, a long answer was kind of called for because I asked you to unpack all of the political landscape and all of the recent events in one question. So you were very concise, considering what I handed you. You've kind of talked about how they intersect, how what's going on kind of intersects with themes of populism throughout Europe. So how is this different from other things that are happening in Europe or even in America? And how is it similar to what we've been seeing in other places?
Yeah, so I think the key difference really between these Dutch farmer protests and populist movements elsewhere is that the policy questions at issue here are very longstanding and very local. So the policy debate really goes back 50 years by now. In fact, the current crisis got triggered when a Dutch environmental organization won a lawsuit forcing the Dutch government to start enforcing the nitrogen restrictions that they for years had tried not to fully impose. That organization was founded in the 1970s to protect a specific nature preserve from the spillovers of agricultural activity, right? So this has nothing to do with climate change. It has nothing to do with EU regulation per se. This is an ongoing fight over, you know, how much land should we use for nature? How much land should we use for farming? That really, you know, dates back to when the Netherlands self-regulated all of these things, and before the debate over global warming or climate change had even really started. And so that's, I think, one thing to keep in mind, because in many of these, many of the populist parties that we've seen around the world tie into themes that I think are a little more global, right? It often is anti-immigration, you know, anti-Islam sentiment, or when it comes to environmental policy, the climate change issues, the green transition, those kinds of environmental issues, not these super local issues per se. And so I think that sets it apart. What I think the farmers have in common with other populist movements, and one reason why they are happy to work with someone like Geert Wilders, is sort of distrust of the establishment, a certain sense that they are getting victimized, or at least are losing their social status. I think also just a broader comfort with politics that are right-coded, or at least, you know, sort of cultural manifestations that are right-coded. And so I think those are that's both a pretty key distinction on the policy level, but then some overlap on the, you know, sort of where you would place them on the political spectrum, or who their most natural allies are, and who they see as the sort of the enemy, which is much more aligned with most sort of, you know, populist parties on the right.
So, okay, this might be a dumb question. Mm-hmm. Why is there, you kind of kept mentioning that they're in the process of changing their governance, or like redoing their government in any sort of way. And I look at this, and then I look at the American Constitution and how old it is, and how, sure, we have our problems, but within this system, it seems to be a pretty long-lasting, workable system. And I just think, wow, like changing the government at a fundamental level sounds so chaotic. And what is kind of the drive behind that? Yeah, why do they need to do that?
Let me clarify that. So In the Netherlands has a parliamentary system. And so in practice, the way things work is that a Dutch cabinet needs to have the support of a majority of the members of parliament. Right? So that's different from the US, where the president is just elected and then he is the executive, right? No matter who controls the House of the Senate. And so in the Netherlands, whenever a new parliament is elected, that means that the, you know, different parties in parliament, of which there are many, because, you know, you get one seat. When there's a general election, the composition of parliament changes, and the outgoing government may well lose its majority in parliament, as happened in November. Then we need a new cabinet, but that needs to have the support of 76 members of parliament. There's no single party that has that many members of parliament. And so different parties need to negotiate over over policies they agree on, personnel they agree on. And it's not always easy to do that. In the current situation, it is, you will need at least four parties basically to put together a majority in parliament. And so you have to find four parties that agree on, you know, enough things to govern together. And so that's the holdup. Now, this is not unique to the Dutch system. It's also not unique to this election. It often takes a number of months for a cabinet to be formed. In this case, it looks like it's particularly difficult. But in the meantime, the outgoing government continues to rule. So the prime minister, who was the prime minister before the election in November, is still the prime minister. If to pass new legislation, the outgoing government still needs to secure a majority in the new parliament, right? So they can't do much. They're a little more limited in what new policies they can pass. The other country that is well known for taking a while to form a new government after an election occurs is Belgium, which, you know, as I think holds the world record for how long that takes. Something that's ironic is that often during these periods when the previous government is still acting, a new government has not been formed, is that they come up with way fewer new spending initiatives, because of course, you know, they've lost their legitimacy, they've sometimes lost their majority. And so you'll see deficits close a little bit during these periods of acting government. I think in Belgium, that's particularly striking, right? There's no new spending programs. And so, you know, that slowly makes the fiscal outlook marginally better. Anyway, so that's what's happening, right? We're not completely overthrowing the constitutional order. We're just trying to find a new majority of parties that can govern for a while. But it's not easy. And so you could have different combinations of parties that have a majority. You could think of different ways in which parliament can relate to the cabinet. So in Scandinavia, it's common to have minority governments where the parties that are in the government do not have a majority in parliament, but they will try to find support for specific pieces of legislation by reaching out to parties that are not in the government. The Netherlands does not have a tradition of doing that, but you could have a situation like that. You could also bring people from outside politics to form a cabinet and see if they can find support in parliament with their policies. That also seems complicated. And of course, you can go to new elections. So unlike in the U.S., elections in most European countries are not automatically set on a date, and there's some flexibility on when to call them. If you're interested in a pop culture rendition of a system of proportional representation like this, I would recommend Borgen, a Danish TV show, which is quite good and really shows you how these coalition dynamics work.
Wow, that's fascinating. I think it's also a great point of clarification that they're not completely redoing their system of government. I was a little lost. I guess from an economic standpoint, if we're using public choice to look at this, it makes sense that it's really difficult to get four parties to come together and agree on anything. So I kind of makes more sense now why it's taking so long and kind of why this shift is chaotic, right? Even if nothing is necessarily happening, it's maybe to put it in context, it makes me appreciate the way that in the U.S., so much of our system, so much of the way each branch is run stays the same regardless of who's in power, because then you don't get that. And I mean, I guess maybe there are benefits to both, but it is just something very uniquely grounded in the way.
Yeah, every system has to manage this, right? Because there's always going to be disagreement between different elected officials. I think one thing that, so in parliamentary systems, the idea, I think, is to resolve a lot of the disagreements ahead of a period of governance. Right, in the UK system, parties issue a manifesto that has pretty detailed plans for what they're going to do. And then usually there's a majority in parliament that then selects. And it's basically a single party system. The government just implements whatever it wants to do and has a majority that's not subject to a ton of checks and balances. In the US, none of the disagreements are resolved before a new period of government commences, right? You have a House, a Senate, and a president. And if they don't agree with each other, then just, you know, nothing happens. And they're not particularly good mechanisms to resolve disagreement as we're seeing in the current situation where we have a possibility of a government shutdown, a partial one next week, and then the greater one 2 weeks after that. We have long running disagreements over foreign policy, over retirement policy, all these issues that linger, and there's no forcing mechanism to get the House, the Senate, and the President to agree on various policy questions, right? So that, I think, you could think of as a relative advantage of these parliamentary systems, where you do have a forcing mechanism after each election, a majority that, if it comes together, can make pretty drastic changes to policy, is sort of compelled to come to an agreement on most important policy issues. Whereas in the U.S., you can just have these, you know, years and years of no progress being made on policy disputes, because there's no forcing mechanism. And I think in the U.S., particularly on the budget side, you do see that problems just don't get addressed because there's no immediate political gain for the parties involved in addressing, I don't know, future shortfalls in Medicare and Social Security. They just continue on without any forcing mechanism to come to a solution until there's a real crisis. And so I think, you know, the downside of the Dutch and other similar systems is that it can be difficult to reach agreement before a term in office starts. In the U.S., the term in office starts automatically, but you have no forcing mechanism to reach agreement. I think, you know, it's going to be very contingent on what's going on, to know which system I think works better in each case.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely right. Do you think that there not being a forcing mechanism, well, obviously it makes issues linger longer until there's a crisis, and we do not like a crisis and the government shutdown, which happens more often than in the parliamentary system. I feel like I can guess pretty validly. Do you think that there is an increased likelihood of reaching the right solution if you don't force a solution? Or do you think that, I mean, as you were saying, that it just depends on what the issue is and what is happening in the country at the given time for one to get the better answer? And I guess there's no way to know what the better answer necessarily is in the long run.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are issues, right, that are just by the nature of the problem easier to solve if you take action, early on. I think that's particularly true for these various old age programs, whether it's healthcare or retirement, where changes you can realistically make have consequences 30 years down the road. I think those are programs where forcing mechanisms are helpful. Of course, for many other issues, the U.S. system has the great advantage that you can sort of adjust as you go. And, you know, in many cases, it's probably fine to, you know, not reach decisions until you're very certain what the right solution is. That, of course, lets you avoid errors in the opposite direction, where you think you've cooked up this prescient technocratic solution and turns out to be a disaster. Right? That is something you avoid if you follow the U.S. approach a little more.
Yeah. I mean, you also have to be careful, though, when we say that, oh, you're taking your time and you're waiting and it's a little more thought through. Who is the one who's making the decision? Is it really more thought through, or did it just take longer to get there? There's a cost and benefit to both, which I think becomes clear here. Earlier, when we were talking, before we started the interview, you were mentioning that, because I'm pivoting now to cannabis legalization.
not very subtle pivot.
No, I'm not. I'm not one for subtlety. You were saying that a lot of the time when people talk about legalization, one of the main things they talk about is all the tax revenue, and that's nowhere near the full story. So I guess the first question on this line is, why study this paper, the implications of cannabis legalization for the U.S. federal budget that you wrote with a few folks at AEI? What was the driver for that, and what are some of the main findings in the paper?
Yeah, so the driver really is that I think there's been a pretty broad-based push to legalize or decriminalize cannabis production and consumption in recent years. We now have a bunch of states that have legalized medical cannabis. I think about 38 or so. So, you know, like 3/4 of the states effectively. And then about half of the states have legalized cannabis for recreational purposes as well. And then in addition, the Department of Health and Human Services in the current administration has recommended rescheduling cannabis from the category that it's currently in, which is the most restrictive category of banned narcotics, to one where there's a little more leeway to at least do research and use it to sell marijuana as a medical drug. And so I think that combination really is sort of groundswell driven legalization effort at the state level and at the local level in some places, combined with the real possibility of federal action, I think makes it interesting to look at what the budgetary consequences are of cannabis legalization. And we decided to write this paper because a lot of the work people have done here, I think it often comes from the pro-legalization side, right? And so they naturally try to emphasize the positive revenue implications of legalizing cannabis. I think they often go overboard in emphasizing how, you know, economically beneficial it would be for two reasons. One, those studies are often very focused on, increased revenue and reduced spending, but increased revenue, just some taxes on selling marijuana, and reduced expenditures from law enforcement in particular, law enforcement and incarceration. and the economic losses associated with that. I mean, that's all fine and well. I think those numbers are usually exaggerated. One, because they count a lot of they basically count all of the activity in the cannabis industry as sort of newly taxed, right? Whereas if you think that this newly legal industry is going to be more sizable than the black market industry is now, a lot of that will just mean that people who are currently working in other industries or capital resources that are currently being deployed in other industries will move to the cannabis industry, right? There's no reason to believe that that generates net new tax revenue. That's just, corporate taxes being collected in a new industry, or it's, income taxes being paid by workers in a new industry that they were previously paying in their old industry. And so I think on the tax side, that's a big source of overestimating the revenue impact. And then on the spending side, I think a lot of these guys are very focused on, oh, we're going to do less policing, less incarcerating. I think they underestimate the potential for the federal government in particular, and this is less of a nation state and local level, obviously, picking up a good chunk of the bill for cannabis consumption down the road. In our paper, and my co-authors and I don't necessarily agree on where we think this will go, we talk about how certainly medicinal cannabis could well be paid for by Medicaid, Medicare, and the VA to a significant extent. And of course, if that were to become the case, then you would see a push to move more and more what I would think of as recreational use through those pathways as well. And so I think that's something that's very much underemphasized. And I think something that's important to keep in mind, just as a back of the envelope calculation, if you impose, say you do a 10% tax on cannabis, right, that gets you, say, 10% of the market as revenue, and at the same time, the federal health programs pick up 10% of the cost of all the marijuana that's consumed in the country through their reimbursements of medicinal marijuana, then the net revenue from those two sources is zero, right? So even if only 10% of the marijuana expenditure are paid to the federal government, that could well offset a significant excise tax. Let me stop there for a moment. But so that's why we're doing it, just because we think, the existing estimates weren't quite capturing what we think of as all the relevant dimensions. And it's an important topic because there's been so much policy movement. Maybe as a small additional point there, the reason why it's important to have a good federal estimate of the budgetary impact is because that will often affect how willing people are to work a policy change into a broader piece of legislation. Right, because if the revenue impact is very positive, it can offset new spending. If it is negative, you will, in many cases, need to find other ways to offset the negative budget impact.
Yeah, and so what do you end up finding in terms of, do we still think that it would be positive for revenue, or is it kind of unclear, but if this, then this might be the way forward?
Yeah, I think your description of unclear, but and it depends on choices made is the right one. And so in the paper, what we do really is highlight a bunch of these other mechanisms that could change the budgetary impact in ways that people haven't always thought of, right? So especially through the health programs, you could also imagine that cannabis farmers will become eligible for farm subsidies. You could imagine that, there'll be discussion on, are you allowed to import cannabis, especially from Mexico? And so there's just a number of policy questions that have been resolved. But I think on the pure budgetary end of things, that back of the envelope that I sketched out to you earlier, where, you get some revenue from an excise tax or a tax on producers of cannabis or whatever, it's not impossible that would be offset entirely by new health expenditure. Maybe not in the next few years, but once you legalize cannabis, I would imagine it will become so normalized that it will be very difficult to exclude medicinal cannabis from these public health programs. And so I think eventually the federal government will end up picking up a good chunk of the bill for cannabis consumption. And 10% isn't that much if you think of how large Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA combined are in the healthcare industry, right? They or just in prescription drugs, they are responsible for a good chunk of the expenditures. And so it wouldn't be completely surprising that even a moderately sized excise tax, something like 10%, could be offset entirely by these new health expenditures. I think that's really the key. For me, that's the key takeaway. And I don't think that's something people have emphasized in the past.
No, not at all. And what I think is super interesting about this is that it's something economists don't do often, which is look into the future and say, this is what we know about how markets operate. And we can kind of talk about how you estimate the market and how you kind of model this, which is also fascinating. But a while ago, I talked to David Henderson, and one of the things he mentioned was that once upon a time, there was an economist who actually saw into the future somehow and kind of thought, oh, well, Easy Pass. He didn't know the name of it because it didn't exist. He was like, this sort of thing is going to exist in the future. And he was right, because he basically used what he knew about innovation and what people want and efficiency to kind of think forward as to what was possible. And I think, especially from a free market perspective, when we're talking about legalizing things and opening things up and all of that, we don't benefit. Then what? Could it actually cause more problems down the line? And that's not to say either. It's just something to be aware of, and correcting the record is so important. So I think that this is super fascinating. And we'll kind of talk about the trade aspect, which I also think is interesting. But I kind of first want to ask you about what obstacles did you have in kind of characterizing the market for weed, cannabis, whatever you want to call it? Weed is just the way I call it, the way my generation calls it. I guess the academic term is cannabis. It must have been super difficult, because even now, when it's legal in some places, it's still underground in a lot of places. Even when it's legal and it's taxed, but the price of the underground is still cheaper, which I know is true in, like, I think it's Oklahoma. I might be wrong about it being Oklahoma. It's somewhere out west. How did you do that? What was difficult about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, there's an immense amount of uncertainty around various aspects of this, in part because, you know, there is no market comparable to the U.S. where weed is legal. By the way, on terminology, so we decided at some point we're going to consistently use the word cannabis, but I can assure you we still on a regular basis have to do a find and replace for marijuana. Is that one that word slips in here and there, and then we swap it out and put cannabis back in just because that's what we've settled on. But yeah, no, good questions. So the market size estimate that we rely on, and it really is a key input, because, you know, once you have the market size, it's not that difficult to, I mean, still, you know, you have to make a bunch of assumptions, not that difficult to calculate tax revenue estimates. But the market size is difficult because obviously right now a lot of the market is a black market or a gray market in some places. And so you have to rely on surveys and guesses to come up with a number. Then in addition, of course, legalization itself will dramatically change the size and nature of the market. For example, as the market professionalizes, so to speak, right? Right now, many retail channels are very small scale or completely illegal. Production does not quite happen at the scale you would expect from other consumer products, right? We don't really see the involvement of the sort of large multinational corporations that are involved in other drugs or food products, if that's how you want to think of it. Right, there's no like Procter & Gamble products yet on the market. And you don't see like massive farming conglomerates really engaged in the production yet either. And so, right, so that's a reason to think the prices will come down. Now, of course, you will still continue to have this wedge between the legal and the illegal market. That, if you're in the black market, you can probably evade some taxes and regulations a little more easily. And so you may still be able to offer, you know, perhaps a slightly lower quality product, but at a lower price. And so I think even under full legalization, the illegal market would not completely go away, especially if trade remains illegal. And so you could try to smuggle cheaper marijuana in from Mexico. I don't know. So those are all things you have to think about. The other thing is that even if you were to know what the new, you know, prices would look like in the post-legalization world, you still have to think about how consumers would respond to that. We have some estimates of the elasticity of demand with respect to price in the cannabis market, but those don't quite come from this situation of full legalization either. And so it's not clear how they translate, because of course with legalization, I think would come a pretty significant norm shift as well, toward perhaps, you know, less stigma, people who, I mean, there's a lot of locations now, including people's private residences, where in many cases you're not allowed to use marijuana. Would that change? Maybe, maybe not. But certainly some of the stigma would, I think, disappear. Of course, if the stigma disappears, does that also make the drug less cool? I don't know. Those demand elasticities, I think, are difficult to translate from a gray situation to a fully legalized market. And so that's, I think, a subset of the problems you have to deal with when you come up with a market estimate. And so, you know, I don't know. Hopefully what we did is reasonable. But part of the exercise also just to show, you know, which assumptions you have to make, where the uncertainties lie, et cetera.
Well, so something I also think is interesting, which you kind of touched on, was that it's kind of dependent on, I don't want to say non-economic legislation, but if there's a regulation about where you can and cannot smoke because of the externalities of where it's going to smell, that is going to affect the way that consumers and suppliers and anyone kind of interacting with this market, it's going to affect the way that things go. And so what are some of the other assumptions you had to make and uncertainties that you kind of realized along the way?
Well, a big one is we assume that after legalization, cannabis will effectively be legal everywhere. But of course, you can easily imagine a situation where many local governments or even state governments will basically make it impossible for retail establishments to pop up. Right? And so that would pretty dramatically change, I think, the situation. Right? Just like there are counties that are dry, you could have counties or cities or states that effectively lease recreational marijuana. I think if there's medicinal marijuana that's FDA improved, I think that would be harder to keep from being sold. But certainly recreational marijuana stores, I think local governments would have a lot of power to block. And so our baseline estimate assumes that doesn't happen and that you can just, that there's just going to be one national market. But I think that could really dramatically affect the development of the cannabis market post-legalization.
And what about trade? So you mentioned something interesting about if it's illegal to import it from other countries or even to export it, right? Because maybe it would go the other way around. Who knows? Even though maybe it is almost a guarantee that we would import it. How does the illegalization, is that a word? I don't know. Of trading with Mexico, for example, how does that influence what might happen in America in the future with respect to this? Or if we opened to trade on this front, how would that impact what happens?
Yeah, we mentioned in the paper briefly just because, you know, tariffs on cannabis would be a natural source of revenue. And you would expect there to be a tariff or a border adjustment if there's going to be a federal excise tax on cannabis, right? You would do that. You would set the tax treatment the same that way. The question of what will happen is very difficult to predict, but I think I would expect both imports and exports. Right? The U.S. is a pretty major agricultural producer. If the U.S. were to fully legalize, I think that would really change the dynamic for other countries as well. The U.S. has really been a strong voice for more prohibitionist policies in the narcotics sphere than most other countries, certainly in the Western Hemisphere. Right? I think there's a number of Latin American countries that have been eager to move toward legalization, maybe not even just of marijuana, but more broadly. And I think if the U.S. flips, they would probably flip as well. And so at that point, you know, you have these two markets where it's legal. Are you really going to ban imports and exports? I mean, maybe in the short run, but I find that very difficult to. I find it difficult to imagine that that's a sustainable equilibrium, because you're going to have different varieties, you're going to have different prices, and so for sure you would have some sort of illicit, imports and exports. But also, it would be so strange to have this completely legal product that you're not allowed to import and export. Maybe the cannabis farmers lobby would become so strong that we would effectively ban imports, right? The way we do with sugar and a bunch of other products. But I just don't know how that's going to happen. But regardless of exactly how it all unfolds, I think it is a consideration to keep in mind, and one that people don't really think about, which is particularly strange in this context, because of course the international trade in narcotics is such a problematic area of policy, and one that the U.S. devotes, you know, a good amount of resources on, one that's really the single largest public policy challenge that Mexico has to deal with. And so it just seems like something you should think about as you ponder what to do domestically.
So what did you believe before you embarked on this exploration of what could possibly happen? And how has your mind changed, or what is like maybe the most important thing you've learned about this or changed your mind about throughout the process? And this is maybe ruining the next question I'm going to ask you, but on this issue specifically.
So, I think for me, the thing I mentioned earlier about how easy it is for medical expenditures to offset any tax revenue, that's not something I had considered personally. And then secondly, just going through the potential budget implications in a somewhat systematic manner just shows you how many different facets of the federal government directly touch upon an industry like this. That's, I think, something, I mean, that's probably true for most products, but it's just something I hadn't really really put together for this particular one myself.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I could talk to you for hours and ask you a million different questions about both of these issues, but we are running up against the clock. So I have one last question for you. What is one thing that you believed at one time in your life that you later changed your position on, and why?
Oh, this is the other difficult question that I know you, yes, you like to ask every single guest. I think and this is, I think, true for a lot of people sort of in public policy of my generation. I don't think 15 years ago I would have come even close to realize how important the housing market is and how important housing policy is to basically every aspect of the economy and every aspect of people's daily lives. And I think that's really an area where practically every Western government has made major self-inflicted mistakes over the past 50 years, just by being much too stringent, much too aggressive in regulating what is allowed to be built and where. And I think it's also really a big cause of people's financial vulnerabilities, a big cause of their afford to live where they would like to live or where their parents live. Or in reverse, people are stuck in places with very weak demand for housing, which in turn makes it difficult to continue to fund public services, makes it difficult for them to move to places that are more promising. I think that's really a policy area where the way in which I've changed my mind is really just about its importance and about the sort of dramatic overregulation of the sector. I don't think that was on my radar 15 years ago, but it certainly is now.
Once again, I'd like to thank my guests for their time and insight. I'd also like to thank you for listening to the Great Antidote podcast. It means a lot. The Great Antidote is sound engineered by Rich Goyette. If you have any questions, any guests, or topic recommendations, please feel free to reach out to me at greatantidote@libertyfund.org. Thank you.